Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome back to the New Books in Indian Religions podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Raj Balkaran. More importantly, I have the dual pleasure today of speaking with Drs. Jonas Buchholz and Ute Huskin. Jonas is at the Academy of Sciences and Humanities at Heidelberg, and Ute is at Heidelberg University. We'll be speaking about a really fascinating work that that fortunately is available open access. The link is in the podcast notes. It's a work called Temples, Texts, and Networks, South Indian Perspectives. Welcome both to the podcast.
Hello. Nice having you. That you're having us.
Yes.
Yes. Oh, you're welcome. And Jonas, it's nice to actually associate a name and a face and get to see you, because of course you're contributing to the Sanskrit narrative volume. So I recognize some of your work as well. So it's great to be able to talk. And of course, I've had the pleasure of collaborating on a research project that resulted in the Nine Nights volume that Ute had spearheaded as well. So this volume as well is the result of a network, a collaboration. So tell us a bit about what's going on behind the scenes to create this volume.
Yeah, maybe I can start. Basically, it is a volume that is one of the results of a DFG's German Research Foundation funded project that Jonas and I had for the last 3 years. And it was about Mahatmyans in Kanchipuram. And one of the activities that we did in the context of this project was a workshop in Pondicherry, which were fortunate enough to have the funds to invite a number of scholars, but then there were also a number of local scholars. And so basically the volume that you see in front of you, or that you can download for free, is the result of this workshop. All of the contributions that are in the volume have been also presented during the workshop. The workshop was actually also a bit experimental in the sense that we first sat in the Pondicherry reading room for a number of days. We're reading together text, which also reflects in the fact that we have a lot of the texts that are being talked about in the article are also printed in the volume. This is one of the beauties of open access, that you can basically put in as much material as you want. And also, so we were reading texts together that related to the temples that we were talking about. And then we had a common excursion to Kanchipuram and visited a number of the texts that we, and a number of the temples that we had read about in the text, visited them, had a look at them. And here, especially Emma Stein was really wonderful, because she also introduced us into her work on Kanchipuram, which she also talks about in one of the articles of the book.
Yeah, we've also had her on the podcast to cover her fascinating work on this super important site in South Asia. Do one of you want to say a word about the Mahatmya genre in this context?
Yeah, I mean, the Mahatmya is our genre that we've been working with very, very intensely in the course of our project in the last 3 years. And I think this volume, I mean, we have most of the contributions in the volume actually are based on Mahatmya sources. So these are texts that are actually very interesting for the kind of questions that we are trying to answer here. And well, Mahatmyas is, I mean, it's, there's always the problem with terminology, because we are using these Sanskrit terms that maybe don't tell us so much about what these texts are about. But we are also using this term temple legends to describe these texts, just in layman's terms, let's say, because that's what they are actually. I mean, they are texts about temples, or let's say about sacred places, that explain the origins of these places through mythological narratives, right? So they ask the questions like, why is this temple here, or why is there this particular form of the deity in this temple, and they answer these questions by telling us stories about the deeds of gods or other mythological beings who are said, that are said to have happened at this very spot.
Eunice, since you're currently speaking, would you like to tell us a little bit about your contribution? It's pretty close to the beginning. I believe it was the first substantive contribution, and perhaps some of the others that you'd like to talk about.
Yeah, right. I mean, so in my contribution, I'm looking at the Stala Mahatmyas and Tala Puranams of Kanji. So, okay, at these texts that we just talked about, and I'm looking at one specific place, that is Kanjipuram, which is the place that our project is focused on, and in fact, quite a lot of the contributions that we have in the volume also deal with Kanjipuram, or Kanji for short. So in a way, it's a very modest contribution, because it's just about giving an overview of what texts there are. But there is actually quite a lot of texts on Kanji. I'm discussing, well, there are at least 8 texts that we know of so far, in Sanskrit and in Tamil. So, okay, that is one, that's also an important aspect of this genre, is that it's multilingual, right? We have Mahatmyas composed in Sanskrit all over India, but we also have them composed in various regional languages in different parts of India, and for Kanchipuram, which is in Tamil Nadu, the Tamil-speaking part in South India, we obviously have texts composed in Tamil. Yes, and what is also, so that's one reason why we actually have quite a lot of texts on this one place. And another reason is that we have texts representing different religious traditions. So Kanjipuram is actually a place with pretty diverse with in terms of its religious traditions, because yeah, 3 major traditions of Hinduism are all very strongly present in Kanchipuram, right? So Shaivism, Vaishnavism, and Shaktism all are strongly rooted there. And actually all of these traditions have produced their own texts. So it's quite interesting to be able to compare the texts belonging to different religious traditions, because they very often deal with the same narratives, but tell them from different perspectives and have different, put emphasis on different things.
Yeah, it's quite fascinating, the texture of these texts, and that they exist in Tamil, there are Sanskrit texts. It's really a fascinating phenomenon. Do we want to talk about some of the other contributions as well?
Yeah, maybe I can briefly talk about the second contribution in the volume. So that is an article by Keinachi Mutu on, it's called A Survey of the Stellar Programmer Literature in Tamil. Okay, so maybe if we talk about, we talked about the terminology before, so sometimes we talk of Mahatmyas, but sometimes we also talk of stellar programmers. So that is also a term that is commonly used to describe these temple legends, these texts about Hindu sacred places. And in fact, in the Tamil tradition, these texts are called Talapuranam, which is the Tamilized form of the Sanskrit term Stalapurana. Right, and yes, and Professor Nachi Muntu's article gives an overview of the Tamil Stalapurana genre. And it's quite an impressive overview of what is actually a major genre, because we have lots and lots of these texts in Tamil. And yeah, that's why we have the good fortune that we have this article by Keinachi Mutu, which is actually so Professor Keinachi Mutu has been working on this genre for a very long time. He's a senior Tamilist, one of the foremost figures of Tamil studies in India. And this article is actually a completely revised version of an article that he originally published in 1985, I think. So you can see that he's been dealing with this genre for a very long time, longer than I've been alive, actually. But he has a very, very broad overview of this part of Tamil literature and shares it with us in his article.
Did you want to talk about the first part of the book, Jonas?
Yes, then if we continue with the contributions in the volume, we have an article by Tiganesan, who is based in the IFP in Pondicherry, which is titled Innovations and Reformulations and Translations, Some Stellar Puranas in Tamil. And this article looks at the relationship between the Stellar Puranas and Mahatmyas in Sanskrit and Tamil, which is also a very fascinating field and one which there hasn't been that much work on it because there is general agreement that the Sanskrit and Tamil texts are related, but very few people have actually closely looked at examples of Sanskrit Mahatmyas and Tamil Talapuranams in conjunction. And Tiganesan is actually looking at three examples on texts on three specific places in South India, so Tiruvannamalai, Kalahasti, and Chidambaram, and comparing the Sanskrit and Tamil texts. And I think that's quite fruitful approach, because you can really see how these texts are related to each other, but also how they have different priorities.
So do we see, I was going to ask this after we've gone over the papers in particular, but this might be a good time. So then in this genre, do we see a lot of overlap with Sanskritic material and Tamil sources, or is it rare, is it common? Tell us a little bit about that phenomena.
Yeah, I mean, okay, I guess one has to be careful of overgeneralizing things, but I mean, I'm mostly familiar with the material that...
You're allowed on podcasts, so it's okay. I'm kidding.
Okay. So generally speaking, the Tamil texts very often or almost always claim to be based on a Sanskrit source. Okay, so the Tamil authors will tell you, I will compose this Puranam based on the Sanskrit text that is told in the so-and-so Purana. And there has actually been quite a lot of debate about this. I mean, it is also a kind of controversial issue, because this whole issue of the relationship of Sanskrit and Tamil is very politicized in Tamil Nadu among Tamil people. And many people have been willing to take these claims of a Sanskrit source as a, you know, just as a convention. Because, you know, because Sanskrit had this prestige, Tamil authors felt that they had to name a Sanskrit source, even if there maybe wasn't one. But in fact, there are also Tamil Stalapuranas that are demonstrably based on Sanskrit texts. And I have mostly been working on the texts on Kanchipuram. And in fact, in the text that we have there, we can very clearly see that the Tamil text, we have a major Tamil text, which is called Kanchipuranam, which is considered one of the major examples of the Tamil Stalapurana genre. And we can show that it is based on a Sanskrit text, which we fortunately also have a Sanskrit text called Kanchi Mahatmya. And we can really read the texts side by side and see that they are very closely related. But it's actually it's fascinating to look at these texts side by side, because you can really see how the Tamil author has transformed the Sanskrit text into a Tamil text. So it almost feels like you can follow the poet or the author in his work of recreating the Sanskrit text in Tamil.
Yeah, it really is a fascinating phenomenon. I'm currently in a collaboration with a scholar named Noor Van Brussel, who studies Bhadrakali Mahatmya, sort of a regional Kerala Mahatmya. And one of the things we're looking at is parallels between the more Pandindic Devi Mahatmya. And so it's fascinating whether there are conscious reworkings of materials, or whether it's a nod to other Puranic materials, or whether it's happenstance, or this it seems that the regional text, at least in this case, is making nods to demonstrate that it's aware of the Puranic corpus, it's aware of Markandeya, it's aware of et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So it really is a fascinating phenomenon. So thank you. And yes, overgeneralization is certainly permitted and encouraged on podcasts. So thank you. What's the next contribution about?
Okay, the next contribution is by S.S. Sharma, and he's talking about the Padmanatha Swami in Thiruvananthapuram. So Thiruvananthapuram is the capital of Kerala, and the Padmanabha Swami temple is it's a major Vishnu temple in Thiruvananthapuram, right? Which became kind of famous. And S.S. Sharma also mentions that in his introduction, there was in 2011, they discovered this huge treasure in the temple, right? So that was in the news worldwide. Because it turned out that there were really extremely valuable treasures in the vaults of this temple. But apart from this treasure, it's also otherwise a very important and fascinating temple. And S.S. Sharma gives us an overview of the myths of origin of this temple as they are presented in various Mahatmya sources. So his paper is also based on Mahatmya sources. But what is particularly interesting about his contribution, I think, is that he shows a lot of, he shows how these textual sources are related to actual present day practices in the temple. So he gives examples of certain rituals that reflect things that we also find in the texts. So there's an example of in the story as it's told in the texts, there's a sage who establishes the temple and wants to worship Vishnu, and then he doesn't know what he can offer to the god, right? But he only happens to have a unripe mango and a coconut, and then he offers those to Vishnu. And in fact, what we find now in the temple ritual is that it's exactly that the deity is offered unripe mango and in a golden coconut shell. So there is this question of how is the actual ritual practice and textual sources, how are they related? Do people do these rituals because they are mentioned in the texts, or do the texts mention them because that is what people do in the temple? So that's a very, I think that's a very interesting aspect of these mahatmyas, that they are related to ritual practices that are actually lived in the temples. Yes, and as Sharma's article does a very good job in relating that the texts and the ritual practices and that are practiced in Trivandrum and the Padmanabhaswamy temple.
And so there's one more paper in the first half that you'll be telling us about, which is?
Well, let me just take over from here.
Sure.
The point is that this is also a good kind of transition in the volume itself, because the remainder of the contributions are concerned either with the connection of contemporary practices or material culture or the geographical actual or today's geographical layout of the land with the text and with legends told in the text. So the next contribution then is by Marzena Czerniak-Droszczewicz and R. Satyanarayanan. That's two scholars who also recently have published an edition of the Mahatmya of the temple town Sri Rangam, namely the Dajadhyayi. And their contribution is in fact about Sri Rangam, but they're in the contributions entitled Importance of Water Bodies in the Mahatmyas in the Kaveri region. So they're talking about the water bodies, both in terms of the river, the Kaveri itself, which is a very important topic in all the Mahatmyas that came up in this region, but also on the Nava Theater. So there's nine theaters around the Sri Rangam Vishnu temple, so Ranganatha's temple. And they're talking about these and also in general about the importance of water and the river for this area. I mean, the Kaveri is an important river with its own Mahatmya and many Sanskrit sources referring to it. So they're looking into this connection of theater, water, river, and Mahatmyas. Then the next contribution is by me. I am writing about, the title is Two Lizards in Kanchipuram's Varadaraja Temple. And what I'm basically looking at in this contribution is how are these two lizards represented in the different texts. So I'm looking at Kamakshi Vilasa, the Vaishnava Kanchi Mahatmyam, and the Tamil text, which is called Tankapali Mahatmyam. And then I look into what kind of role do these lizards play in contemporary ritual practice. And basically these are two reliefs of lizards that are at the temple ceiling, and they are very closely connected to this, to the rituals connected to Palipatana. So the idea that if a lizard falls on a specific part of your body, then this means something. In most cases, it means something negative. And so people actually come to the Varadaraja temple in order to get rid of these doshas. And they do so by touching the lizards. And so for many pilgrims, actually, the lizards are the main reason why they go to this temple. So Vishnu as Varadaraja in this temple is in this context, not really of major importance. So I'm looking at how these lizards are, the reason why these lizards are in the temple, how this is represented in the text, how the, let's say, later text, the Tankapali Mahatmyam in Tamil, which is from 1937, I think, how this is kind of a mixture between different aspects of the text and how this relates to contemporary practice. The next contribution then is by Malini Ambach. Malini is a PhD student here at Heidelberg University, and she's also working on Kanji Mahatmyams. And in this contribution, which is entitled Reading a Sacred Place Differently, Sava Tirtha in Kanchipuram Sanskrit Mahatmyas, she looks at this huge temple tank, which is at the northwestern end of Kanchipuram, and looks at the representation of this tank in the different Sanskrit texts. So she used three Sanskrit texts as the basis for her considerations, and explains how this temple tank is embedded differently in the different sectarian versions, basically, of this place. Then there's a contribution by Eva Dibinska-Borek, and her contribution is entitled Connected Places, Networks of Shrines, Arubilam in Nets of Spatial Relationships. So she offers an outline of patterns of spatial relationships, and she does so by tracing different modes of constructing a meaningful space, and her example is Arubilam. So she's talking about, which is a kind of remote area, remote in terms of accessibility, remote area in Andhra Pradesh, where there are 9 or now 10 Narasingha shrines. And so she looks at this place in terms of how is it connected? How are the temples among themselves connected? So she looks at the hunting festival where one of the Narasinghas is going in procession to different sites. Then she looks at Arubila as part of the 108 Divya Deshams. She looks at a connection between 3 Narasingha places, which are Kanchi, Arubilam, and Sholingur, but also looks at bigger networks along the Nalamala mountain range, and also at relationships between Arubilam and Sri Shailam, which are expressed not only in the Arubilam Mahatmya, but also in the Sri Shailam Mahatmya. And then there's a contribution by Crispin Branford entitled Building Networks, Architecture, Ornament and Place in Early Modern South India. And Crispin looks at, in general, he's pointing at the importance of material culture. And he looks at temples and the different modes, how they are replicated in different sites, how they refer to each other, but also to other spheres like Vaikuntham or... So, and his argument and what he's showing in this contribution is that temples and shrines can be replicated in architectural ornament or in murals, where networks of temples are referred to, for example, in Sri Vaikuntham. He refers to patrons and artists as, let's say, agents that create connections between different temples. And of course, the ritual of pilgrimage, which is when pilgrims go from one place to another, there's a connection. And what he's showing is basically that the creation of links, and I'm quoting him here, the creation of links and connections between temples and their construction and visualization in design and ornament was only a gradual process from the 14th to 15th century. So his argument, and I think this is to be taken very seriously, is that we also have to look at the time frame in which such strong networks were created and are now perpetuated. And then the final contribution in the volume is by Emma Natalia Stein. We talked about her already, about her work on Kanchipuram earlier. Her contribution is Grounding the Text, Kanchis or Urban Logic and Ambitious Extensions. And so she talks about ancient processes of urbanization that she detects in Kanchi structure. She talks about the role of temple building and expanding in the process of urbanization. And she describes different styles of building that can be traced in Kanchi even today. She traces the likely place of the royal palace, which doesn't exist today anymore, which is near the Kamakshi temple, and argues, which is also an important argument in her monograph, that the temple, the orientation of the temples, which is unusual, it is towards the main road running north-south. And in the end, she also takes one smaller temple, namely the Tirukaleshwara temple, as an example, and analyzes its structure, iconography, and history. So that's a whole range of contribution to this temple text and network volume, which I think shows in a very nice way what we can gain from investigating a specific place through its text, but also in conjunction with its material culture.
Yeah, there's so much that's fascinating about the volume as a whole, no doubt. Your fascinating individual contributions. One thing that came to mind as you talked about the backstory was in this sort of pseudo post-COVID world that we're fumbling about through, is the irreplaceable value of getting together in a room with a bunch of people and reading or speaking. Or there's so much about the online world that's here to stay, and that's beneficial for a variety of reasons. You know, I can zoom into a class across the continent and give a guest lecture, for example, but really it's not replaceable, is it? To the just getting together with folks and collaborating in this fashion, and clearly this work is a direct result of that process. One thing that you've certainly touched on in all the contributions, but maybe we should flesh out for the audience, is this importance of networks and what you mean by network, and that being such a crucial contribution of this work as a whole. Could you say a bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, in general, most of the contributions look at temples, look at the text not as text about kind of monuments, but about nodal points in networks of connections. And these connections can be textual or intertextual. These connections can be by people walking from one place to another. These connections can also be through the ideas that are carried by people, or that kind of overarch the different temples. And that's exactly what basically all of the contributions are pointing to say, yes, on the one hand, we have to do this in-depth research. But on the other hand, we need to raise our head and look at other places as well and look at how these places are connected, be it through people, through actions, through text, or whatever it might be.
Fascinating and so important. And as you mentioned, sometimes we're very good at staring at a particular crevice and mastering all knowledge about a little crevice, and then, yeah. But to understand, you know, to sort of continually toggle between the sort of laser focus and then the more global view. I think it's a crucial, particularly in the South Asian context, where there's so much synergy with between Sanskritic and non-Sanskritic traditions, between practice and text, et cetera. Now, having co-edited these volumes, was there anything about this enterprise or this collection that ended up surprising you? Were there sort of suspicions that were confirmed? Were there insights that were sort of new to you? You know, could you talk a bit about what that process was like for you, or perhaps what struck you or you learned or crystallized through this process?
Well, I can definitely say that one important aspect, and that also touches upon what you mentioned right now, this being together in one place. But one important aspect for me was definitely when we were visiting as a group the different sites. And when we could be together in the specific temples, look at specific, let's say, inscriptions or constructions or lingams or whatever there was, and talk about it and discuss it while we were there. I felt that this was, I mean, I always feel that the work, let's say the combination of work with text and the combination with sites, people, and whatever there might be, that is mutually enriching. And in this case, being in this group of learned scholars who all had their different contribution to what we were looking at, that was really very enriching. I found that great. Yeah.
Yes, and we were very lucky, actually, because this workshop and the excursion that resulted in this volume eventually, that was in January 2020. So it was just before COVID hit in. And of course, we had no way of knowing at the time, but that was really the kind of the last chance to be together in one room with all the scholars who contributed to this volume, but also to do this excursion to Kanchi and visit the sites that we read about. Visit the actual sites. That is something that then wasn't possible for a very long time, and now slowly we are getting there. But in this respect, our timing with the workshop was quite fortunate.
Without question, because then not only do you have the fortune of having gotten together just at the twilight of the old world where we could get together, but then you have you've got this time where it's you and your data and your computer, and you may be able to go to the cafe or not depending on where you live. And so then you had this opportune moment to I was talking to I believe Simon Broadbeck, who's just published a monograph on yugas and the avatara in the Mahabharata, and he was saying that's why this came out so relatively quickly, because of COVID. So the dual benefit, rather than have COVID delay your field work, you had it sort of perhaps support the making sense of the field work. Is there anything else about the volume that you wanted to touch on, anything at all that comes to mind?
Well, I definitely would like to emphasize this is open access and can be downloaded from wherever you are, as long as you have an internet connection. And I must say that, I mean, since it came out, it's only maybe 2 weeks ago, I've gotten so much feedback already on the volume. And I do think that the accessibility and the free accessibility is really wonderful. It was also, I mean, usually when you publish a book, it's always very expensive if you want to include images. And we could include many images, also color images, which I think also enriches the understanding of what we're talking about. And that is something that I really appreciate. So it's published with Heidelberg Asian Studies Publishing, and whoever wants to publish South Asian studies related books there should contact them. They're happy to publish.
I think that's such an important point, that we can have access instantly. I tease that I can't afford my own Routledge volumes and my students not so much.
Yeah.
These barriers can be problematic for a variety of reasons to a variety of people, whether because of their studentship, because of their geographical location, because of the currency in which they earn globally. And so it's no small boon to have this instantly available. And without question, it translates to greater impact. It just translates to so many more people coming across it. I was happy that I suckered in McComas Taylor to co-edit this Sanskrit volume, because he's got ties. He's a prophet at Australian National University, and they also have this vibrant open access press. And without question, when this comes out, which hopefully will be in a few months, certainly in 2023, it'll just have so much more impact. So do have a look at the link in the podcast notes, and do consider publishing with this fine press. Fantastic. So I think we will close for today. And so thank you very much for appearing on the podcast.
Thank you for having us.
Yes, thanks a lot.
My pleasure. For those of you listening, we've been talking, of course, about a really, really fascinating collection of papers. The volume's called Temples, Texts, and Networks, South Indian Perspectives. The link's in the podcast notes. Until next time, keep well, keep listening, and keep contemplating the connections across practice, text, and beyond. Take care.